How did some of the most controversial images of modern science become textbook fare? Nick Hopwood explores this question in his impressive new book, Heckel's Embryos, published by University of Chicago Press in 2015. Hopwood is reader in History of Science and Medicine at University of Cambridge. You can see the images Hopwood discusses during our interview in a new online exhibition, Making Visible Embryos, which explores visual culture as part of a Wellcome Trust research initiative from generation to reproduction. I'm Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University. I interviewed Hopwood along with two graduate students, Patrick Anthony and Zipporah Champion, as a capstone project for my course, New Approaches to Science and Technology Studies.
So, Nick Hopwood, welcome to the New Books Network. This is Laura Stark, and I'm talking with you with Pat Anthony and Zipporah Champion here at Vanderbilt University about your fantastic new book, Heckel's Embryos. And so first, I just wanted to describe this fairly remarkable book to listeners, because it's not every day you come across a book that's 18 chapters, more than 200 images, 400 pages, and a weight I actually can't quite estimate. It's quite heavy and large, and it is gorgeous. I think one of the people writing about the book described it as sumptuous. You must be really, really happy with the production of this, given that it's a book about images.
I'm delighted. I mean, the University of Chicago Press have done a fantastic job. And we were very fortunate to have a grant from the Getty Foundation that made it possible to include over 200 color images. So it's really meant that, as you say, it's a book about a family of images, and it's meant that I can argue almost as much in pictures as words through the book. In case people are listening or are worried that 18 chapters sounds a lot, I should say they're quite short chapters. So although the book is nearly 2 kilograms, I hope it doesn't feel too long, and there are lots of pictures to look at on the way.
Yeah, the pictures seem essential to it, and I also feel like the chapters were surprisingly brief in terms of the body, the prose of it, but the relationship between the text and the prose is really uncommon, I feel like, in a lot of academic writing, and just to produce such a gorgeous, sumptuous object. As you phrased it, the book is about a family of images, and it gives us a 150-year history of this particular family of images, but it relates to the work of Ernst Haeckel, who was a Prussian German in the late 19th century, and he was an embryologist, and his people think that they know Haeckel possibly, but you give him some interesting new interpretations, but really foreground the life, the production, and the afterlife of the images he produced. So I wonder if you could just start us off by telling us about the visual context that Haeckel was working within in late 19th century Germany, and specifically to talk about the influence of Romanticism, the influence of debates about specialist privileged knowledge as opposed to popular knowledge, science as popular knowledge, and the visual strategies that people used in terms of using serials, serial representations of images as a very common form of visual argument.
Yes, so Haeckel is this very famous and in some ways notorious German zoologist who's a member of the first generation to attain an independent chair of zoology in a German university in the mid-1860s. And he's been trained in university courses that use a wide range of visual aids to introduce the forms of organisms to students. They were very much schools for sight, these university classrooms. And in a way, what he's going to do is take images from those classrooms and display them to a much wider audience. But that had already started to happen by the time that he himself, as a child, as a youth, is reading illustrated books produced with the new techniques of the relatively new techniques of lithography, wood engraving, produced more cheaply for a larger audience. And you mentioned serial images, and these images that the book is about, these embryos, are an example of a serially organized image, and that was something that became particularly prominent in the decades around 1800. Images of series of all kinds, but most importantly, embryological series that represented the course of a pregnancy or the development of an animal in a series of images representing progressively more advanced stages. And these then became some of the most important representations of progress in the 19th century.
One of the things that you show is that using series was a common practice, and at the same time that the way that Haeckel used series was very innovative in that he used what the images that became iconic, as you argue, were the embryo grid images. And so it's interesting to see how, despite the fact that there were conventional practices, there was a way in which to be novel in this context. And so here I'm going to hand it over to Pat to talk with you more about Haeckel and the embryo grid.
Okay.
Hey, Nick, this is Pat.
Hello.
So Haeckel's probably most famous for this phrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, meaning that the development of the embryo expresses the evolutionary history of the species. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about how Haeckel's embryo grid illustrates this concept, and also how this embryo grid reflects 19th century ideas about progress in nature, teleology, and the great chain of being.
Okay, so I mean, let me start by just trying to paint a picture of this grid so that everyone knows what we're talking about.
Perfect.
These are images that, in their canonical form, have rows and columns. The columns represent vertebrate classes or species, culminating in humans, and the rows represent developmental stages from a relatively early to a relatively late stage. In the most developed forms of the pictures, the top row, all the embryos look pretty much the same. That's evidence of common descent for Haeckel. And then they diverge down the page towards the adult forms. And so that is the most striking thing that the pictures show. One of the revisionist arguments in the book is that it's maybe a mistake, but don't worry, it's one that specialists have also made, to assume that since Haeckel is famous for ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, the idea that we climb our evolutionary tree in the womb, because he's famous for that, these embryo grids must primarily illustrate that concept. Now, it is a concept that runs through his books. Since fossils weren't so available, embryos were extremely important evidence of evolution. It's also true that we can see examples of recapitulation in the grids. But it's not the most obvious point. The point that really leaps out is that the embryos start similar and then diverge. And that's also, I mean, that's what it's fundamentally about. It is also supported by the reconstruction I've done of how the grids were built up initially from pairs of drawings so that are put together and actually only become a grid in the second edition of Haeckel's History of Creation, the book that does more than any other, perhaps, to take a developed Darwinist system to the reading public. We're talking now from the end of the 1860s through to the First World War. So ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That is a very important frame, but pictures have a life of their own, and they're not just readouts of the theory. In a way, they're more general and more open to different kinds of interpretation. I think that's one reason that they lasted so long and could be used by so many different people for so many different purposes, including sometimes against Haeckel.
You use the wonderful phrase flexible resource to describe what is, I take to be, the main point of the book, was to try to understand what makes images successful. So thinking about the story of these images as flexible resources, they're often attached to the man and the character of the man, Haeckel, who was, he's now known for being an embryologist, for being Germany's sort of most well-known supporter of Darwinism, and also a supporter of popular education for science, and also as a forger. But I really admire the way in which you recast the very conventional questions of basically rendering a judgment on Haeckel's forgery by asking who is making these charges and what was the context in which these charges were taking shape. And one of the interesting things you show is that it wasn't just in specialist circles. And in fact, the immediate aftermath, the charges came up relatively late. The immediate aftermath happened and then was sort of shut down within specialist circles. And it really only opened up at the first inflection point of the three that happened in this book. So around 1875, 1909, and then 1997. This first inflection point was really taking place in a broader popular context. And it was not just the embryo images that were contested. So I'm wondering if you could set us up what was happening in 1875.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, in a sense, paradox that drives the book is that these embryo grids are some of the most widely seen embryological images and some of the most famous images of evolution right through the 20th century. But Haeckel is accused of forging these pictures and others very early by colleagues who don't necessarily oppose the theory of evolution, but do oppose the interpretation that he gives to it and the uses that he makes of it. Yes, you're absolutely right. I've tried to stand back from the question, well, so did he forge them, and what does that mean for Darwinism? I mean, I do give an answer to those questions. Haeckel behaved as recklessly with these illustrations as he did with everything else, but there was no intent to deceive, and he had very little to gain from it. And of course, modern molecular evidence provides even more support for Darwinism than Haeckel could have imagined. But what I look at between the first charges in 1868 and when the debate really takes off, that first phase of intense controversy in 1875, I look at how initially the people who are really in control of this are the German professors who teach embryology and who have to decide whether they're going to come out against Haeckel's images or not. And as you said, it takes a while for this to take off for various reasons, but to a significant extent, because the majority of the teachers of embryology see the pictures in their argument for similarity among vertebrate embryos as confirming something that they already knew, or at least thought that they ought to remember from those lectures that not all medical students had really enjoyed. So it takes quite a bit of work by Haeckel's critics, and especially the Swiss anatomist and physiologist Wilhelm Hiess, to argue that not just is Haeckel wrong about using embryos as evidence of evolution in the way that he does, but he's also played fast and loose with the truth in his illustrations. And actually, Hiss argues that for this, Haeckel should be practically excommunicated from the community of researchers. What's at stake there is an extremely important disciplinary dispute over how embryos should be studied. I mean, should they be primarily evidence of phylogeny, of evolution, or should they be studied physiologically to try to understand the mechanisms in the here and now by which one stage becomes the next? And those are really two major frameworks for late 19th century life sciences that clash here in a particularly important way. So that is, you know, everyone who accuses Haeckel of forgery and who will over the following years and decades have some axe to grind against him. And that is the most important one initially. But it's given added charge because this is a time when middle-class readers in Germany are learning about Darwinism and it's the main phase of the reception of Darwinism in Germany, and Haeckel is the leading figure in promoting this. Haeckel, the German Darwin, as he's often called, is happening.
Go ahead, Nick.
And at the same time, there is a very big controversy between the church and the state in which Haeckel is fighting, and a lot of concern among professors in the sciences that they want to negotiate a relationship with the state in which they're free to research but agree not to teach controversial topics, especially involving religion, and Haeckel is writing roughshod over that, and those are really the things that are causing a lot of trouble.
Yeah, you have this wonderful phrase that really resonates with the recent objectivity debate, so thinking of the work of Dastin and Galison, but your phrase of learning how to see depended on learning what to see. So the issue of what's happening in this debate and then what forms of visual representation are privileged and prioritized is the way in which this is playing out. You give a really remarkable reinterpretation of this controversy, and here I'm going to hand it over to Pat.
Yeah, I'd like to draw some attention to Chapter 7, Visual Strategies, and this is where you challenge Lorraine Dastin and Peter Galison's argument that the debate between Ernst Haeckel and Wilhelm Hiss can be seen as a clash between the virtues that scientists associate with competing types of illustration, what Dastin and Galison called truth to nature and mechanical objectivity. But you've argued that these debates were not so much about scientific illustration as the conduct of the scientists in presenting those illustrations. So could you tell us how your argument differs from that of Dastin and Galison, and also what's at the heart of the tension between Haeckel and Hiss?
Gaston and Gunnarsson are surely right that some of Haeckel's rhetoric illustrates opposition to mechanical objectivity. I just don't think that that was the main issue here. And I don't think they disagree with me. What I think is going on is partly that Haeckel is engaged in a defense of morphology against the increasingly quantitative physics-oriented physiology that was his main disciplinary enemy and that Villon-Hiss represented and is really trying to import those approaches into embryology. I think the second point is that larger issue about the limits of science and the kind of restraint that that scientists should practice. And that does link to the mechanical objectivity argument, but it's quite a bit bigger. And that's the basis on which Hiss is intervening and criticizing Haeckel's use of evidence and with a very strong moral charge. Well, I've tried to go a bit further than what especially Lorraine Daston has written about this case, is to say that ideals and even practices of drawing are all very well and are very important, but of course these are not projected directly to readers. So what we're seeing when we look at their books are the products of the much more practical activities of printing and publishing, the different ways that pictures could be put on the page. And so that's what I explore in that chapter, really, looking at two of the most famous and important books in the history of embryology, Haeckel's Anthropogeny and The Letters on the Form of Our Body by Villon-Hiss, and exploring those as, I think, rather daring experiments with genre and illustration that kind of create a very different relationship of readers to the pictures, corresponding to the different attitudes that Haeckel and Hiss have. So Hiss, just to give one example, Hiss's book, where he's talking about a very mechanical way of understanding the embryo and how it develops from one stage to the next, contains very vivid physical illustrations that are designed, I think, to really give the reader a sense of what it might mean to fold up the tissue and make organs out of it.
In thinking about the ways in which publishers and translations worked, it seems like in thinking about the success of an object or a family of images is especially interesting in this case, because as you show in the sort of second inflection point in around 1909, this relates to the production of the sort of cheap pamphlets in which the images from Haeckel, the embryo grids, actually start to become iconic, as you say, based on the 1874 image. And so it's interesting to see what that does to historical interpretation. Instead of seeing the 74 embryo grid as always already iconic, to see how this actually only happens 35 years later. And part of this happens through the reproduction and the reworking of the embryo grid in different national contexts. And so in addition to the impressive historical length of the book, you also expand out into the translation and the publication in the U.S. and the UK, not only in German-speaking countries. So I'm wondering if you could talk about the role of publication in these broader national contexts for sort of stoking and reforming the controversy about the images.
Yes. I mean, as you say, the key point is that the pictures don't become famous just because they're in a book by Haeckel. It is the ways that they're copied into other books by him, including into these relatively high circulation pamphlets, but also into other books about evolution and into encyclopedias. So that's what lets them at least take the first step on the road to becoming iconic. And that happens in interestingly different ways in the English-speaking world and the German-speaking one. In Germany, Haeckel is very well known, and it's also rather well known that he's taken some liberties with his illustrations. So especially when the second phase of intense controversy takes off, as you say, in 1909, when this really does become front page news, the question of forgery, the pictures become so hot to handle in a way that although some supporters continue to use them, there's really no way that they're going to be introduced into textbooks in German schools. It's extremely controversial that Darwinism even be taught in schools, partly because of the controversies involving Haeckel. In the United States, by contrast, Haeckel, although by the early 20th century, very famous too. I mean, he's the most famous living evolutionist worldwide by that point. The details of the controversies are not so well known. And although it's known that he takes liberties with illustrations, those thoughts are not really attached specifically enough to the embryo grids. So they are copied into high school textbooks from as early as 1900 and have a long then and very successful life in American high schools and colleges. So it's going to be quite a different story in the different language contexts. And that, of course, provides some of an answer to the paradox that I mentioned earlier. How can the most controversial pictures in the history of science, and they really are extraordinarily controversial in hundreds of magazine and newspaper articles and several independent publications, how can these incredibly controversial pictures become standard textbook illustrations in the 20th century? So that's partly why it was important for this book to deal with the Anglophone literature as well as the German.
Yes, and especially in because we're talking to you from Tennessee, the Scopes trial, Tennessee versus Scopes, is especially resonant still here. And you use the phrase content cloning to think through what is happening with the use and the reworking of the images, despite the fact that you would think that textbooks would stop using them. And what you seem to be arguing is that it's not just the sort of the default, the mindless copying, as Stephen Gould would have it, but that, in fact, this has to do with, again, various publication strategies and the context of both public education and Darwinism and creation debates in the United States. But one of the other ways in which the images continue to be copied, and so this seems to be the part of the essence of what makes a successful image, is that it's not just one image that's preserved and that there is an original, but actually how many there are. And so that seems to be the paradox that you're showing. One of the ways that this happens is through the ways that standards are set that not only are in negative response to Haeckel, but actually absorb Haeckel's images. So thinking about the normal plates and the standards produced in that way. So I'm going to hand it over to Zipporah for this question.
Hi, Nick. So in speaking of normal plates, could you just walk us through some of the standards that were created during that time, especially around that area?
Yes. So Haeckel's pictures are, as we've been saying, very successful because they are copied into so many places and will have this long life. But they're also important, and perhaps more surprisingly, for the effect that they have on specialist images in embryology. So an argument that I make in the book, and I'll be interested to see to what extent my colleagues will accept this. I make the argument that the disputes that Haeckel launches so destabilize embryological illustration in the 1870s, especially of human embryos, in which there is understandably most interest, that his opponent, Wilhelm Hiss, as part of a monumental work, which really founds human embryology as it will be practiced for much of the 20th century, in that work, Hiss sets up a new kind of visual standard, a so-called normal plate, plate of norms that represents individual specimens as a kind of standard against which then new specimens can be assessed. And this kind of standard is reworked by later generations, including by experimentalists who have somewhat different interests. And ultimately, those become the normal stages that are still used in every developmental biology laboratory today. So there's a way in which Haeckel's pictures that, you know, some people dismiss as merely popular, just for teaching, not to be taken seriously, they're actually, I mean, they were always for a dual audience of his peers, the professors, and lay people. But they, I think, goad the production of the most authoritative and standard images. So one effect that then has is that when later researchers are looking at Haeckel's pictures, they're also judging them by these standards that have actually been set up very much against what Haeckel was doing. So that's the story with the normal plate.
Yeah, and in thinking about how or what makes an image especially iconic is that sort of the phrase for an unknowing pornography is you know it when you see it. But actually, the strange thing about iconic images is that you know it before you see it. So this seems to be one of your claims about the peculiar way in which some images, including these embryo grids, are iconic, is that people have standards which were in part come out of those images themselves when they first experience the images. So it's really one of these interesting reverberations that you show. And the image just keeps on living. And this comes up again in the later 20th century, and your final inflection point in the book comes in, again, the national context in the late 20th century. Here's Pat.
Yeah, so you show how, in spite of the controversy, and maybe because of the controversy surrounding these images, they survived through the 20th century and even into our own. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about these most recent public appearances of Haeckel's embryos in 1997 and 2010, and what these reappearances tell us about the social life of images.
Yes, so these embryo grids, having been copied in initially especially American textbooks through the 20th century, even in books that are adopted in the in Tennessee in the immediate aftermath of the Scopes trial, and are copied in other countries as well. But there is one important class of book that they've hardly been copied into, and that's books devoted to embryology. They only, as far as I can find, enter embryology books in the early 1980s. So from there, as developmental biologists became more interested in the whole problem of embryology and evolution, which had been rather neglected in the middle of the 20th century, they start copying these pictures more widely, including into quite advanced, into review articles, symposium volumes, and quite advanced textbooks, and maybe looking at them more carefully. And so that's how it comes that in 1997, a British developmental biologist, in ignorance initially of all of this history, and he wasn't unusual in being ignorant of it, he accused Haeckel of forgery. This is Michael Richardson in London. And he had an axe to grind as well, in the sense that he's arguing against the impression created, especially by the first row of Haeckel's images, that that there is a conserved stage at which all vertebrates look the same. Richardson is arguing that that's not right. That's an impression created by these pictures. That actually natural selection is acting on that stage too and producing diversity. A lot has changed by the time this forgery charge is made. It's picked up in the Times newspaper and from there in other newspapers and in Science magazine then in the United States. And from there, the newly much more powerful neo-creationist movement for intelligent design latches onto this controversy. And really the combination of scientists now being reluctant to use the pictures and creationist pressure around textbook adoption decisions and the like leads the pictures finally to be taken out of the textbooks within in some cases within weeks or months, but pretty broadly within years. That doesn't mean that the pictures suddenly go away. In fact, it's now with this huge controversy, ways of arguing where we expect to see a picture when we hear an argument about a picture, and the takeoff of the internet mean that the pictures are suddenly more available than they have ever been before. In a way, it's only now that they really become icons. Of course, for the advocates of intelligent design, they're a kind of negative icon. They're an icon of Darwinism as a forgery. They're no longer icons of evolution in a more positive sense. But even this, you know, I have to say, when I first finished the book manuscript, when I finished the first draft, I thought this was how it was going to end. I thought, well, they probably will survive, but only in this sort of creationist use of them, and people like me, historians of science, will use them, but they're almost excluded from biology. And then at the end of 2010, as you indicated, the pictures are reproduced, not just anywhere, but in perhaps the most sought and after space in the whole of science publishing, the cover of Nature, the international weekly journal of science. And they're reproduced there in a very unusual form, made up of a mosaic of stained fruit fly embryos to argue that new genomic techniques had confirmed the existence of this conserved stage that Haeckel is associated with. So, I mean, what that really shows is not just that pictures can hang around for a long time, but that they are copied because of the rather specific ways that they can be used to make arguments. And it shows how they're not just hanging around, but they're still involved in innovation. This mosaic was quite an innovative thing to do, and actually this cover spawned a software program that can be used to produce other mosaics. So they're really involved in visual innovation, 140 or so years after they were first produced. So that's why I was pleased to be able to end the book on this case that encapsulates what I call the shock of the copy. We perhaps tend to think of copying as derivative, unoriginal, boring. What this case shows is just how creative, contested, and consequential it can be, how much this can matter if we want to understand why we see particular pictures in particular places.
It's a really nice recursive point that you make, that we expect to see an image when we hear an argument about an image. And these images live on today in 2015 in your own book, in Heckel's Embryos. And so here I'm going to hand it over to Zipporah to wrap us up.
So still on the point about the recycling and reemergence of images, I was wondering, how do you think the image has evolved or even found its own life with your own creation and recopying of the embryos?
That's a nice question. I think that's why I'm so pleased that it was possible to include so many pictures in this book, because what it's meant is that I can, in various ways, contextualize and recontextualize these pictures. It's been said that iconic images gain their power by casting into the shade all of the other images that were produced around the same time. And so that's how Heckel's pictures can come to stand for the whole of comparative vertebrate embryology, something that would have shocked and appalled the expert comparative embryologists of his day. By putting them in the context of the pictures that Heckel copied to make his own, other pictures that were produced around the same time, and then the various copies that were produced from his images, and at the same time to marshal visual evidence of the ways that they were produced, the ways that they were read in different places at different times. I'm not trying to rob them of their iconicity, but I am trying to open them up, make them an image that we can look at again, and in a way turn them from a kind of dead icon that we just take for granted, like surely generations of school children did in those textbooks, into an image that is not just controversial and doesn't just have to do with where one stands on Darwinism, but can help us understand how some images out of the thousands that are produced succeed in monopolizing a topic, coming to stand for a whole domain of knowledge.
Nick, thank you so much. You've been incredibly generous with your time, and your book is so much more than Heckel. It's a really incredible, I think, theory of visual representation and material culture and so much more. So thank you for talking with us about Heckel's Embryos.
Thank you very much for reading and for all your questions, all three of you.